is called Nobody Is Gonna Turn Us Around. And of course, it's a song from the civil rights movement. And if you listen to the lyrics and what they're saying, they're announcing what they're willing to do. And they're talking about an attitude that they have towards a system that is violently repressive. And they're not only asserting themselves, but they're singing together in a way to say, this is what we're about to do. And there's major examples with, obviously, the March to Selma, where they tried to march to the capital of Alabama to talk to the governor. And they were beaten by the National Guard on the Edmund Pettus Bridge on Bloody Sunday, it was called. They broke into a airing of the trial at Nuremberg on national television to release these images of these peaceful marchers being bludgeoned and gassed by the Alabama National Guard. And then several days later, they managed to carry on this march to the Capitol. So all I'm trying to say here is that the content of the song and the way that it's sung has implications for how we understand changes that are happening in society, and in this case, a very specific historic moment. But so when they sing, Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Us Around, it's not just a poem or lyrics. It's a political and cultural statement. And, we followed it, of course, with Mavis Staples singing down in Mississippi. Mavis Staples said that when her father was the pastor, Martin Luther King Jr. came to the church, and they said, well, what does our singing of hymns and gospel music have to do with Martin Luther King? And her father said to her, if he can preach about it, we can sing about it. And her song, Down in Mississippi, talks about seeing all the segregation signs growing up and how she lived to see the signs come down. Change in the legal system of who can eat and live and drink and do what where, right? And then in between, we had John Lee Hooker singing The Motor City is Burning. Does anybody know what that song is about?
Detroit riots.
The Detroit riots, of course. Covered by the MC5 much more successfully. Now, I am Octavio, and this is the long 1960s awakenings, music, and social change. And it is important that you feel free to ask questions. Because if you've been to any of my other talks this week, I think that meaning is made amongst the group. And so it's not one person up front tells everybody what to think. It's we encounter the material together. And what we take away is a shared experience. And that is the truth. And though that's a sketchy word. So, let's begin the way we began. I want to go around. Everybody tell us your mother's mother's name, your name, your mother's mother's name, and what language she spoke. Just to locate us in the space.
And she spoke English.
Thank you. So we're now located in time and space through our umbilical cords. Right? Your umbilical cord connects you to your mother and back on through time. So you can contemplate your belly button and be with your ancestors. Okay. So I always like to do that because it gets us together in the space. With multiple meanings under the ground and so on and so forth. And that's part of why we talk about the long 1960s. Okay, so I wrote this thing over here, and they keep telling you have to shorten the scope. And I was trying to talk about the 20th century and the role of radio and country and folk music and blues as it becomes a foundation for sort of popular culture and music throughout the 20th century before the rise of rock and roll, which leads to heavy metal, and jazz is in there, of course, and then you lead to hip-hop and the rise of the internet and all of these things. And they kept telling me, that's too much, you can't do that. So after many conversations, we end up with a decade, and I'm like, I don't want to write about a decade. Decades are arbitrary. I mean, that's not the moment when things change, and that's why I settle on the long 1960s. Because if you're going to talk about the 1960s, you have to start at least with World War II. And if you're going to start with World War II, well, you really got to start before World War II. Because history is not even when you encapsulate something, it didn't just happen, right? There's strains of thought, there's debates, there's cultural conflict, there's unseen trauma and things that are carried on for generations. And all of this stuff leads to what becomes the 60s generation. Again, it didn't just spring out of nowhere. It was there was a response to the Cold War. It's a response to McCarthyism. It's a response to all kinds of things. And of course, do you know the festival at Altamont? What was the festival at Altamont?
That was the Rolling that was kind of the West Coast alternative to Woodstock. Rolling Stones were the headliners. The Hells Angels were the security for the festival, and a Hells Angel shot a black or stabbed a black visitor, a black attendant
who was waving a gun around. Yes,
yeah.
And it's all caught on film and widely released in the Maisley Brothers film Gimme Shelter, documentary centering on the live murder of a concert goer. Thank you for that summary. People say that this killed the 60s. It's December 6th, 1969. People say it's the end of the flower power movement. It's the end of the counterculture. And this is also why I say the long 1960s, because the ideas and the debates that arise in the 60s, the questions about the character of the American country and cultural identity, these continue to be debated. We're revisiting and relitigating some of the exact same questions that were being struggled over in the 1960s, right now. And obviously people growing up in the 60s, or people whose parents grew up in the 60s continue to have meaning. And we're still not sure what the decade means. Life magazine called it the decade of tumult and change. And everybody has opinions about the 60s and so forth, and it's basically reduced to a stereotype at this point. And when you look at the time period there and the events, there's just so much in question. And obviously there's a tremendous amount of music and culture. Changes in what you can wear to church and who can preside and all kinds of questions. Society changed through this time period. And so that's why I say the long 1960s. It's a way to look at an era, but placing it on a continuum of the present and the past. And recognizing that, you know, this is going to go on into the future. People will say something about the 2020s, but it's not just about the 2020s, because it's also about 2001 and 1984 and so on and so forth. Very good. Questions so far? So, one of the things that I looked at was the idea of awakenings. Most people are familiar with the idea of the two great awakenings in the United States. And these are periods of religious activity, let's say, where a revival happened, lots of people got involved, there's a certain kind of preaching generally, there's a certain focus on your personal experience of Christianity, the encounter with religion. And these are looked at periods of transformation in American society. But what I looked at it as more is as periods where a society revisits what its core tenets are. So it's a time when norms are breaking down, when things don't seem to be working, when people aren't finding their needs met by the established order. And so an awakening is the process over a generation where a society works out some of these things. And in many cases, it's a appeal back to an earlier time before things were corrupted by the current power, the current people in power. And this happens again and again in history. It's called a revitalization movement by anthropologists, where you say, oh, the people in charge have lost their way, and we're going to appeal back to just before these people that lost their way got in charge. And that's exactly what the Puritans were saying. It's part of what leads up to the Civil War, and you can argue it's something that happens in the early 1900s with a move towards modernization. So. Anyway, I looked at this as the 1960s as a period of awakening. First, for the African-American community around the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Liberation Movement. And I didn't just come up with that idea. There's a historian who calls the 60s awakening involving the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and other groups, saying that African Americans changed the way that they thought about being black in America. And they also changed the way that they thought about their music and their culture. And this was a reoriented attitude towards, well, this is what America says it's supposed to be, and here's what we're going to do about it. And adopting certain styles of dress and clothes, and I said that already, and attitudes reorienting themselves towards what they were going to tolerate. And so you have arguably an awakened group of society saying, we are going to change, we're going to demand that we're treated equally, which is what your documents say. And you can make the argument that because they believed in the ideals that underpin the American sort of experiment, that's what they brought about. All sorts of other possibilities. And I put this into context with the counterculture and saying, how is this also a part of the 60s awakening, where society shifts how it functions and what we allow and so on and so forth. And back to everything I just said.
I'm with you on the concept of awakenings. I've just never heard of the concept of the two great awakenings in American culture. Do you mind just briefly?
So the first great awakening is George Whitefield and it's sort of in the early, the colonies time, and it's going around itinerant preaching and holding revivals, and sort of like, it starts in this room, and then all of a sudden, somehow, all over the mountain, people are hearing about this and coming. And you can't really, I have spent a lot of time trying to find an explanation that actually makes sense, and I have not. That's the essence of it. Something happened, and it caught on and traveled around, and people came together, and there was more of this. The characteristics are usually sort of charismatic preaching, a focus on individual experience, and kind of the spread of this identity. And it's like, it's those are the characteristics. It's not really quantifiable.
So it's a religious context.
Yes.
Okay.
And then the second great awakening is Jonathan Edwards. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, the burned over regions of New England. That means that the revival spreads to such a point that people are tired of hearing all of this. And, so these are moments where you can say that the American people negotiated how they understood themselves. So the first Great Awakening has to do with the idea of America, the colonies, as a separate country from England, and the establishment of a national identity. The Second Great Awakening also is a shift in this sort of way towards the United States is a country that's going to take over the continent. So Manifest Destiny is like a result of this process. And you could say that the Third Great Awakening leads to an idea that American democracy should be exported through military means. So the involvement in World War I is a result of the Third. And people don't really recognize the Third Great Awakening with as much enthusiasm.
Thanks.
Excellent. So then the question is for me is, how does social change happen? And what does it mean? And You know, a lot of people talk about social change. We say we need social change. Social change is good. But if you really look at what social change means, it means a change in the norms and the attitudes of a society. And that's not necessarily good. Social change can be towards a more repressive or destructive attitude towards the world and each other. And so it's just one of my things to think about in terms of what social change really means is not, oh, it's a step forward towards equality or more access to justice. It's a shift in the way that society operates. And some of the ways to think about this have to do with technology, where, if you go back to country music singers playing music on the radio and only being able to make a living playing music where the radio reaches, to the idea of, as somebody brought up, everybody can stream things on their phone. Nobody even has to play an acoustic instrument, let alone go buy a physical record. So this change, this is a shift in the way that we are. And I can go on about that, but I'm not going to. So part of what I am very interested in, of course, is music. And how does music convey ideas? And how is music a cultural expression of a people's identity? And how does music help people that are struggling or feeling alienated or separated? What role does music play in helping people, helping sustain people, or changing the conditions in which they find themselves? And so I was very interested in the freedom songs of the civil rights movement. And I guess I should just tell, I mentioned this before, but so when I was 13, I first heard Tupac Shakur's record, Strictly for My N-Words. And I never really understood what living in the United States was all about. It didn't really make a lot of sense to me. There was great contradictions. And when I heard Tupac as a 13-year-old, suddenly I was like, there's something here that I feel that I don't really know how to articulate. And that sort of rounded out part of how I understood my experience. And coupled with that, I saw this interview with Bernice Johnson Reagan. And she's a civil rights singer and activist and eventually scholar of African American music. And she said that, well, the song sustained the movement. The songs changed their attitude. The song changes your condition. And I don't see anyone having struggles separate from music. I would think that a movement without music would crumble. Music picks up people's spirits. That's Reverend C.T. Vivian. When I saw Bernice Johnson Reagan say all of this, it was just one of those moments that resonated with me. And it was like, so you're saying that the songs were part of what held the movement together. It was part of how you prepared yourself. It was part of how you negotiated the feelings and the struggle throughout. And that completely shifted my understanding. So what I'm saying, these two stories are part of why I began to look at music more seriously, as it were, as a space. And so the freedom songs are songs that were sung as part of the movement. They're often begun in churches, or they're based on church songs. The words are changed. And we're going to see a video about some of that. And it's the you're back to the Selma Bridge. The people are singing a song as they're going forward before this happens. And they sing songs about it. The songs tell stories. The songs capture the time. And when you have, I have this wonderful book of, it's by a guy in Candy Carawan. With the introduction is by Pete Seeger, I think, and Pete Seeger says he was at the march trying to write down the songs that he heard, and this woman came up to him and said, "You can't write down freedom songs." And they recognize this, and yet this book has all these stories of the different parts of the movement with songs that they sang, notated as they're able. I wanted to bring it, but I didn't. I pass it around at this point. It's just a songbook with little stories about this song came from here. And I think it's an excellent time to show the video. So,
can I?
Yeah.
Shall we go upstairs and close those blinds?
We can turn off the light. Do you have a question?
Yeah, so is the focus of your attention on songs that are like the catalyst for change, or is your attention also to songs that are the soundtrack of change?
My attention is to music as a potential space. I have a whole four-point thing about how music can function, where it comes from, and what it can be understood to mean. So at no point do I want to be said to be claiming that music needs to change, or that music is just entertainment. My attempt is to consider all of the possibilities of the way that music can be made use of. And when you consider something like freedom songs, which are an expression of deeply held values and the understanding that people have of themselves, music can also be tied to specific efforts, nationalistic efforts to exclude and drive out ethnic minorities. And it can also be a way of trying to placate people. It can be an effort to distract them. It can be just droning in the background. So there's all kinds of ways that music can be made use of. And my goal is to keep in mind that this is a space of potential, not an essential aspect. At any point, while taking seriously the use that is made in these instances.
Okay.
I can press play. Would you like me to go grab those while we're...
I will turn off this light. I think you can see it okay.
The sit-ins took the movement from the bus protests to the lunch counters, the place that's reserved for white people. The owner of the restaurant either got to serve me or arrest me. And if he arrests me, somebody's going to take my place at that lunch counter. And if they arrest them, somebody's going to take their place.
We were prepared to sit in. We just didn't wake up one morning and said we were going to go and sit in. We studied. We studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We studied what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he accomplished in India.
In Nashville, we were trained for nonviolence. Jim Lawson was our main trainer.
If someone is playing a segregationist role, then by all odds, you must try to feel as much as you can the emotional life of a segregationist for this particular moment.
We recruited students and clergy and laity who took these training workshops.
I was asked to role play a white policeman ordering some black people to leave a counter. And I said, okay. And I went to the counter and I said, please, sir, it's illegal for you to be here. Won't you move? And everybody in Lawson's workshop collapsed in laughter and said, the Southern white police are not going to say please, and they're not going to say sir and ma'am.
And when it came time for us to sit in, we went into the downtown area and we occupied seats at a lunch counter in a Woolworth store. And we'd be sitting there in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion, waiting to be served. Some of us would be doing our homework, reading a book, writing a paper. And some of us would look straight ahead, just waiting and waiting, but never served.
As in Montgomery, these things are typically accompanied by regular scheduled mass meetings where people speak, tell us how we've done from the last meeting until now, how things are going, and it's always accompanied by singing, which pulls the group together.
Singing got us involved. I remember this very hippie white couple named Guy and Candy, and they came and they taught us a lot of songs.
So Guy taught, I'm going to sit at the welcome table, and it was during the sit-ins. You taught it to the sit-in students that first weekend. Do a little bit of it now so we can hear how it sounds.
I'll play it and you sing it. Gonna sit at the welcome table. I'm gonna sit at the welcome table one of these days, hallelujah. I'm gonna sit at the welcome table. Gonna sit at the welcome table one of these days. I'm gonna feast on milk and honey. I'm gonna feast on milk and honey one of these days, hallelujah. I'm gonna feast on milk and honey. Gonna feast on milk and honey one of these days.
Then we probably would have went on to another store. But if you keep denying us, then we're going to keep going back. And that's what we did.
Well, it's just not the things we're used to down here. I mean, they come in and they sit down, and we're not used to them sitting down beside us because I wasn't raised with them. I never have lived with them, and I'm not going to start now.
You see, these white people are crazy. They're absolutely clinically insane.
Some places, such as Memphis and here in Jacksonville, Florida, the sit-ins led to violence.
Spit on us, or put a lighted cigarette out in our hair or down our backs, pour hot water on us, pull us off their lunch kind of stools, or beat us. But we kept coming back over and over again.
We absorbed the pain in our own bodies rather than to fight back.
No one ran. No one swung a fist back. No one balked at being arrested.
We wanted to assure ourselves that the nonviolent approach was a winning approach.
You know, I haven't always been nonviolent. We had to work hard on that. We knew things were going to happen. You know, the only thing you had to do is just pray that you were not killed in the process.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? My daddy was a freedom fighter, and I'm my daddy's son. And I will fight for freedom till every battle's won. Oh, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, boy?
The strategy of the Freedom Rides was to find a way to get the movement out of the cities and into the rural South, where the problem was far more serious and complex.
And the idea was to have integrated teams ride two buses from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans, Louisiana.
So when the call went out for the Freedom Ride, I volunteered for a group of black and white citizens of America to even discuss the possibility of boarding a Greyhound bus. It was very dangerous.
The Freedom Riders attacked a basic premise of white supremacy, that black and white cannot be physically together. And the only way they could think of stopping it was by beating the people within an inch of their life, and they did.
Oh, Lord, I'm ready.
It's in Alabama where they face what you can only consider as chaos.
In Anniston, bus pulls over at a little country store. They started breaking the windows, and within seconds, some incendiary device was shot aboard the back of the bus. And I heard them holler, "Let's burn them niggas alive, let's burn them alive." I'm hitting hard against the door. They wouldn't let us off. At that instant, the fuel tank of the bus blew up. When it exploded, the crowd scattered, and that was the only way we were able to get out of the bus. I remember coming out of that bank of smoke. A guy came up to me and said, "Boy, are you all right?" And I thinking, okay, yes, yes, I'm okay. So, you know, almost thank you for asking. And then he hit me with something.
You just can't guarantee the safety of a fool, and that's what these folks are, just fools.
Mississippi had a reputation that dwarfed Alabama. And we got to the Mississippi line, we didn't know what to expect. But the first billboard we saw, huge billboard, "Welcome to the state of Mississippi." The next billboard right behind that said, "Prepare to meet thy God."
For whatever reason, people thought that I should always lead the singing, and I usually did. We would constantly be singing, and then you start making up lyrics. "Hallelujah, I'm traveling. Hallelujah, ain't it fine? Hallelujah, I'm traveling to Jackson this time." Got into Jackson. The Jackson police could not wait to get their hands on us. We had an assembly line arrest of the Freedom Riders. My case was one of the first ones. And the judge wanted to know how I plead. And before I could say anything, the judge said, "You're guilty, don't waste my time." 6 months.
So, a couple things about all of this. The civil rights movement arguably started in January of 1960 with the sit-ins. People talking about these. But that's not really accurate. The Montgomery bus boycott was in 1955, and there was a long tradition, some people call it the black radical tradition, of people finding ways to counter or resist post-Reconstruction, Jim Crow, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody knows who Rosa Parks is. So Rosa Parks was not the first person to be arrested on a bus for not standing up. Irene Morgan was arrested in 1947 for exactly the same thing. Everybody knows the March on Washington in 1963. There was an earlier March on Washington by A. Philip Randolph. And other people, they marched on Washington in the 40s. The Freedom Rides, which we just saw here, these were drawn off of the example of the Ride of Conciliation put on 1947 also, I think. The point is, everything that we focus on in our history of as part of the Civil Rights Movement goes on way before that. It draws on things that have happened, and people were resisting the racist attitudes of the United States since the beginning. And it's important to keep that in mind. So then there's a whole series of events, obviously, where song plays an important role. But I want to talk a little bit more about the Freedom Rides. There's another wonderful clip with Bernard Lafayette, which I do not have on DVD. So we're not going to watch it, but I'm going to tell you about it. So the Freedom Rides start off in Washington, D.C. It's specifically 13 people in 1961. It's begun by the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, which had a very strong background of Gandhian principles and nonviolence. And their goal was to travel through the South and challenge segregated interstate travel. And so that was the plan, and they were expecting problems, and they were hoping to force the federal government to step in and desegregate international travel, which was what was already what they were supposed to do. And so you saw that there. They rode down to Anniston, Alabama, and the bus is bombed, and everybody is injured. And Core decides, because everybody's hurt, and they can't find anybody to ride the bus, that they're going to give up the rides. And that is when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Nashville and other places sends people down to continue the Freedom Rides. So just a little tip. John Lewis does not join at the start. He comes down with this second wave of people. And there's a huge debate about how you're going to get the Freedom Rides out of Alabama. And they're protected by... They're finally, the Kennedys step in and send in the National Guard, or rather the National Guard is mobilized to protect Freedom Riders on their way to Mississippi. And so, James Farmer is on the bus and he says, "We got to the border between Alabama and Mississippi and saw that famous sign, 'Welcome to the Magnolia State,' and our hearts jumped into our mouths. The bus pulled off the road, stopped. The driver left the bus. Another driver got on. The Alabama guardsman left the bus. The Mississippi guardsmen replaced them. The Alabama director of public safety came onto the bus and whispered something to one of the reporters. Reporters were there too, because this was the big story of the day, and they wouldn't miss it, even though they were risking their lives. That reporter then passed the message to the other reporters on the bus. All but one of the reporters left the bus then. I asked him what the message had been. He said, 'The director of public safety has told us that he has received word from usually reliable sources that this bus is going to be ambushed and destroyed inside the Mississippi border.' The Freedom Riders do not get off the bus, and Farmer describes the landscape and visions of Harriet Tubman in the past. But I shook my head and came back to reality, and there were Mississippi National Guardsmen flanking the highway with their guns pointed toward the forest on both sides of the road. So the ambush does not materialize. And as they get into the suburbs of Jackson, Mississippi, something happens, a moment of defiance, catharsis, and joy. One of the Freedom Riders begins to sing, and this was as it had to be. His words went something like this: 'I'm taking a ride on the Greyhound bus line. I'm a ride in the front seat to Jackson this time. Hallelujah, I'm a traveling. Hallelujah, ain't it fine? Hallelujah, I'm a traveling down Freedom's main line.' All the Freedom Riders picked up the chorus, and then we pulled into Jackson itself." So in this moment where death is very close by, they're singing this song as a way to say, we're not turning around. And they get to Mississippi, and everybody is arrested. And it's noted that, quote, "the songs help to dissipate the fear. It is an assertion that they would not allow themselves to be dehumanized by a system that is functioning in an inhuman way." So they arrive in Jackson, Mississippi, and they go in through the waiting room, and everybody is arrested. And the governor of Mississippi is Ross Barnett, I believe, and he sends them all to Parchment Penitentiary, which is a federal prison in Mississippi. It's well known. And they are charged with trespassing, and they're all going to spend 60 days in Parchment Penitentiary. And this is part of where all of this action, all the people getting involved, the civil rights activists say, "We are going to fill the prison." So they asked for volunteers. Who's willing to go down and spend as long as need to in jail to get this thing to change? And so then this is where the songs in prison, that's part of the book I mentioned. There's all kinds of songs that come from Parchment that are dealing with the conditions in the prison and talking about singing in there, even though the that they close the windows during the day so it gets horribly hot, and they open the windows at night and turn on the fan so it gets terribly cold, and there's insects and bad food and all the good things you can imagine in the penitentiary. So, James Farmer from the penitentiary in Parchment, the male freedom riders were in one very large horseshoe-shaped cell block. As a way of keeping our spirits up, we sang freedom songs. The prison officials wanted us to stop singing because they were afraid our spirit would become contagious and the other prisoners would become freedom riders as a result of our singing. They said, if you don't stop singing, we'll take away your mattresses. People were quiet for a while until finally Jim Bevel, who was a Bible student at the time, made a little speech pointing out what they're trying to do is take your soul away. It's not the mattress, it's your soul. Then everybody said, yes, yes, we'll keep our soul. One freedom rider then yelled, guards, 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 and the guards came dashing out to the cell block to see what was wrong. He said, come get my mattress, I'll keep my soul. And everyone started singing, ain't gonna let nobody turn me round, turn me round, turn me round, gonna keep on a walking, gonna keep on a walking, keep on a walking to the promised land. And then the bit with Bernard Lafayette, it goes back and forth with him and Hank, the singing person we just saw, where Bernard Lafayette says, they're in there and they're gonna take their mattress. Okay, so they're in there and they said, well, all the buses are coming, we're gonna fill up the penitentiary. So they start singing, buses are a-coming, oh yeah. Buses are a-coming, oh yeah. Buses are a-coming, buses are a-coming. Buses are a-coming, oh yeah. And he says they're trying to warn the jailer, so they start singing, better get you ready, oh yeah. And then the jailers come in and say, stop all that singing in here. This isn't the playhouse, this is the jailhouse. So they all go quiet for a while, and then he says, what are they gonna do, put us in jail? So they start singing again. And that's when the mattress thing comes down. They say, we're gonna take your mattress. And so they start singing, you can take our mattress, oh yeah, you can take our mattress. So they take their mattresses, as we just heard. And they keep singing, because they're trying to keep their spirits up in prison. They're trying to remind themselves that being in jail is not everything, and they're trying to communicate with one another, singing for each other at night, so on and so forth. Pass the time. And they're threatened again, and so they say, we're going to take your toothbrushes. And so they start singing, you can take our toothbrush. And he says, ah, but then we stopped and said, there's four of us in a cell meant for two people. He says, so it's close quarters. He says, so we learn to sing with our mouths closed. You can take our toothbrush. And I wish we could just see him singing. But this is just one example where, from the individuals that were there, songs were the balm of the moment, the backbone, as they say. And the songs that speak to Parchment Prison specifically, songs about other moments, the March to Selma, where there's a guy with one leg on crutches who went the whole way. And Len Chandler is singing, pick them up and put them down, left, left, right, right, anyway. All of these songs play a role in different moments in the civil rights movement. And unless you have questions, I'm going to read something else. Bernice Johnson Reagan said, when we sing, we announce our existence. Singing is running the sound through your body. You cannot sing a song and not change your condition. The vibrations run through your body, they run through the air and fill the space. In the process, change occurs. After the Freedom Rides, they moved to Albany, Georgia. It's called the Albany Movement. Not popularly known, but this is where Bernice Reagan Johnson, Johnson Reagan becomes part of the movement. She says, with a song, there was nothing they can do to block what we are saying. Not only did you call their names and say what you wanted to say, but they could not stop your sound. Singing is different than talking, because no matter what they do, they would have to kill me to stop me from singing if they were arresting me. Sometimes they would plead and say, please stop singing. and you would know that your word was being heard. And then Mississippi Freedom Summer. Never mind. The point is, the civil rights movement, as we popularly talk about it, spanned at least 6 years in the early 1960s. Historians sometimes call it the good half of the 60s, when everyone was nonviolent. But there are all these different circumstances where people challenged the law, people challenged the structure, people stood up to being beaten and jailed, and in many cases, if you tried to register to vote, you could get fired, lose your job, et cetera, et cetera. And all the while, they kept pushing. It was like Curtis Mayfield's, and they keep on pushing, right? And in many of these examples, there are songs that relate to specific experiences. And the songs arise in these experiences, but the songs also tell us about these experiences. And that is why I also view music, songs, as a kind of repository of history. Because they come out of a specific context using the instruments or the technology of the time, and they announce something that maybe can't be, it's not necessarily meant to be understood by everybody, but it's a way of communicating. So music is functioning in all of these different levels. And there's another clip from this movie that, because of the disc, this guy says, you know, we'd be in the church, and, you know, often the sheriff or somebody would come into the meeting to try and intimidate people. Sometimes they'd have their dogs with them. And so they had the song, "We Ain't Scared of Your Dog." And after you sing it a couple of times, you're like, hey. And then they say, well, yeah, we're not afraid of your jail either. And now everyone's singing, "We're not afraid of your jail. We're not afraid of your gun." And part of what Vincent Harding, you know who Vincent Harding was? Mm-hmm. That's okay. That's your homework. he said, when he was meeting with activists in the midst of, you know, disappearances and so forth, he would say, when we sing "We Are Not Afraid," we mean we are afraid. We sing "Ain't Gonna Let My Fear Turn Me Round," because many of you might want to turn around now. So, as well as to take into account that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee used song training as a way, as an organizing tactic. It was a way to, when you get to a new community, you teach them freedom songs first. And part of the reason that they call it a Black Awakening is because people who have been oppressed so long with certain negative stereotypes about themselves and certain ideas about what they're capable of doing, when they start to say, that's not me. We are good. And we do have an important history. And we are going to embrace it. And not only that, we're going to sing out and let people know as part of our efforts to change the way that the system operates. So, hopefully that's coherent. Any questions?
Can I share a story?
Sure.
I have a friend who's an older generation than me that was privileged to work with Martin Luther King for that march on Selma. Is that the one with the bridge?
Yes.
And I think she was there. But she always tells a story that kind of goes along with what you're saying, that when they came up on the bridge, they didn't know that the National Guard was going to be waiting on the other side of the bridge with dogs and clubs, and you couldn't quite see it coming. But so there's this moment when the march got to this point where suddenly they crested and saw that they were marching into waiting violence, and everybody paused, and then somebody mm-hmm. started to sing, and mm-hmm. then they all started singing forward.
And this is one of those things where when you watch the video, it's like a lot worse than you think or remember, because all the marchers are actually on the sidewalk. They're not like blocking traffic. They're not threatening anybody. They're not doing anything illegal, really. And the thing unfolds with this just like wave of brutality, and people are running away while they're being beaten and gassed, and it's like, you know, we hear about these things, we try to talk about history, like, oh, everything's gotten better. Well, it didn't just get better on its own. And that's the kind of moment where you come up over the hill and it's like, this is really what's waiting down there. And it's interesting when you hear accounts of the Freedom Rides, of being on a bus pulling into a white town where, like, you know you're going to get beat. The question is, are you going to get killed? And then, of course, you get into the legislative aspects of, is the president going to act on behalf of citizens of the United States for their own protection? And that's something else that happens during the Freedom Rides, where everybody's gathered in this church after all of this happens, and they're not sure if they're going to get out of Alabama. And the church is surrounded by 1,500. I guess there's 1,500 people in the church, and they're surrounded by a huge mob. And, you know, they're on the phone with the Kennedy administration saying, you know, are you going to let us all be killed in here? And they're singing songs to say, you know, we're ready. And at that point, this is partly where the National Guard does intervene, finally.
Where do you see sort of music and modern activism intersecting? Do you see it intersecting the same way? Do you see it intersecting differently, or am I talking about something that you will get to later?
No, this is a question I get every time. People say, well, how does this relate to today? Is it happening today? Is there a social vision in the popular music, in music that's being shared? And I don't see it.
I was gonna ask that too. I was gonna ask that of younger people, if you're hearing something that I don't, because the whole time I was growing up, so much of the music was about social justice and doing something about it. And I think I may be listening to the wrong radio stations or something, because I don't hear it.
And that's a very interesting piece, which I am theoretically going to get to more, is the way that sort of rock and roll, when it sort of came out, became popular, like, it represented an entire attitude. Right, it's not like, oh, everybody listened to rock and roll agreed, or that it has a political message, and that's a big debate between different artists. I mean, my quote from yesterday, Mick Jagger saying, it's stupid to think you can start a revolution with a record. This is, you know, street fighting men in Chicago. But I guess, you know, what you see with this is there's like a cultural trend of people who are saying, we don't want to do it like our parents did it. We don't want to be the Cold War. We don't want McCarthyism. And rock and roll, in some level, spoke to that subculture, that development of an identity or an attitude. And, well, I don't see a similar consciousness in anything popular that I hear. I wouldn't discount the possibility that there is a cultural identity involved that does reflect certain attitudes that, you know, are aimed at. I mean, the most political person is Lizzo, who's saying, like, you should feel good about yourself, and when I shine, everybody's going to shine. Like, and is that a radical political statement? You wouldn't think so.
Wait, can I just... I just feel like I can think of so many more political songs than that, and like Tribe Called Quest, or like Ice Cube Arrest the President, or like.
But if you look at the history of Ice Cube and hip hop, Arrest the President is hardly. I mean, there's a gap in the middle there, I would suggest. I mean, the point is, if you look at early records by Ice Cube, or early compositions by Ice Cube, I mean, he's always had a political ideology, but that's the point. He goes, Tribe Called Quest as well, they're not new. Mm-hmm. They may have released something new in the present, but it's like, that kind of ferment that grounds what hip-hop originated as. There was a consciousness that was very clear there. And the point is, it's certainly not the majority of songs that you hear. And much more, it's like, oh, you put this thing in a music video and say that you're an ally. And the question is, well, what are we doing? And what is the movement for at this point? It's an interesting question. So in that sense, I don't see it, but that doesn't mean it's not there, but it's also a question of, well, what would it even look like at this point? Because at the same time, when you go to protests today, in my experience, there's not people singing songs, and you would be hard-pressed to start a song that everyone would sing, partly because there's not a shared background like with this, where everything began in the church and people were using, back to yesterday's talk, they're drawing on religious songs and bringing that out into the street. So, and I have a whole other thing about hip hop. We're not going to talk about it. Any other questions?
It seems like recently, since 2016, since our country became the way it's becoming, it's like we lost all the gains that we might have made at one point in this country, and it's turned around. There's not only the civil rights movement and the women's movement, there was the anti-war movement, all these things happening together, and then things just stopped.
And that's why I also, that's why I think about awakenings and the long 1960s, because, again, all of this agitation about women in church leadership and the Chicano movement and the environmental movement and all these things that come out around and through the 60s. You could argue that all of them have been rolled back or are being rolled back, and that there's more sort of legislative interference happening, possibly any time in the 20th century. These are arguments that could be made. But one of the interesting frameworks that I looked at was the sense from very right-wing people that they were deeply upset with Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society and all of the so-called progress of the 60s. And they felt that the last 60, 50 years were, they were trying to get back to where they were before Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy. And then you go in to look at how the 60s are used by different politicians in presidential cycles. So how you feel about whether or not blacks should vote does tend to correlate with some of your other attitudes politically. And
when you say getting back to the way things were, I mean, are those persons saying it socially, religiously, politically, economically, philosophy, it's like, what aspects?
That is the framework that I got. That's the point of why something like Make America Great Again, what was being implied there was we want to go back to the 1950s before all of the civil rights stuff.
It seems so strange that that's pervasive because that era, I mean, most of the people that reveled in that era and that liked that era, see, they're dead or dying. I mean, it's like.
And if you look at the history of awakenings throughout in the American context, every one of these is appealing to something that wasn't real in the first place, or is unattainable in the present. So, I mean, the entirety of Puritanism is we are pure and we're rejecting this current establishment which has wandered off the path, right? And so this is what, like, as I was doing all of this and I was watching this unfold, and it was like, this is exactly the same pattern. This happens over and over and over again. And in this case, it's a very blatant appeal to, I want to go back to before everyone was yelling about their rights.
Take the rights away.
Take the rights away. And it's the, you know, there's and but to read it from the perspective of, you know, Ronald Reagan was a hero, and when he was governor of California, like that was the start of like our comeback kind of. Ronald Reagan was governor of California, and he had some very repressive ideas at the time, let's say. And just the point is to look at the past 50 years from this angle of that right-wing conservatives are upset because they've never had what they wanted since then. And just as a thought experiment, And so part of my question, of course, is what kind of a country is the United States going to be? Because if you look at the 60s, you've always had, you know, just look at the 60s, we've always had this element. And something else that I do want to talk about is, you remember the Democratic National Convention of 1968? What happened?
In Chicago.
In the riots. What happened?
Don't recall details.
Okay.
I just remember seeing it on TV, the violence going mm-hmm. on. And Mayor Daley mm-hmm. was a huge figure in it.
Oh, yes. Okay, so to skip over a whole bunch of stuff at once, we talked a bit about the freedom songs and the civil rights movement and the progression over time. And then I look at the idea of a counterculture. What does a counterculture mean? Where does it come from? And I don't think there's any question that what we associate as the counterculture arises alongside and in response with the civil rights movement. That was all going on in the early part of the 60s, so the counterculture is aware of this. And you can argue that the counterculture generally had to do with more educated white folks, white liberals, and so on and so forth, but there was a cultural trend that was unfolding, and it involved the anti-war movement and all of these other things that we've already spoken about. And there is an element of rock and roll as a motivator, as something that appeals to people, as something that has a message or an identity involved. And so one of the things that I just want to put that into context of, if you have such a thing as a counterculture in the later part of the 60s, one of the big moments is the Democratic National Convention of 1968, because Robert Kennedy is killed, and there's a tremendous amount of the Vietnam War, which was quite popular at the start, was becoming less and less popular. Right? So people don't usually recognize that, but the Vietnam War had general support at the start. And as it became less popular, as people became more concerned about Muhammad Ali's point, there was a great amount of tension around who was going to be the Democratic candidate, and were they going to stop the Vietnam War?
Could you iterate Muhammad Ali's point?
It was the point of, the Viet Cong are not calling me an N-word.
Right.
Why am I going to go over here and blow up these people when, you know, John Lewis says that they can send troops to Cambodia, but they can't send the National Guard down to Selma to, you know, protect the citizens. What are we doing in Vietnam when Oakland has all
right.
of these problems? And then the overlap with anti-Vietnam sentiment with all of these other movements, I mean, that's where Martin Luther King gets into trouble, is speaking out against the Vietnam War, and so on and so forth. So, the Democratic National Convention is envisioned by many different leftist groups as an opportunity to make themselves seen and heard by disrupting the process. And there's a whole lot there. They nominated a pig for president called Pigasus, who was put into custody. And then the rest of them were arrested, and they are in the jailhouse, and the cop comes in and says, "I got bad news for you, boys, the pig squealed." So the build-up to Chicago, there's an attempt to draw all of these musical acts into it, to show the musical revolution of John Sinclair from yesterday. Different artists are concerned about not getting the permits. They're concerned that there's going to be a police riot. People don't want to get beaten up and gassed by a very overactive Mayor Daley. Mayor Daley takes every ridiculous claim that he hears about LSD in the water or screwing the police in the street or all of these different things, and they call in, I think I have it written down, all the 10,000 policemen on 24-hour shifts and the National Guard and the FBI, and everybody's in Chicago to stop anything from happening. And of course, these claims are quite far-fetched. But so the point is that the groups that are trying to protest often don't get permits. And so a lot of different musical acts don't go to Chicago. And then what happens is very quickly it turns into a moving street battle with the police. And Hubert Humphrey is nominated because Lyndon Johnson decides not to run. I do know this. The point is the Democrats nominate somebody who loses to Richard Nixon in the general election. Richard Nixon becomes president until 1974. Good times. There's all of this rhetoric around music is going to set us free. Music is the... let me find some of this. And then, here we go. Rock and roll is the only way in which the vast but formless power of youth is structured, the only way in which it can be defined or inspected. It is indeed so powerful and full of potential that it has its own unique meaning and its own unique style and its own unique morality. This is the rhetoric that adherents to music's power were making. Join us in Chicago in August for an international festival of youth music and theater. Rise up and abandon the creeping meatball. Come, all you rebels, youth spirits, rock minstrels, truth seekers, peacock freaks, poets, barricade jumpers, lovers, and artists. We are there. There are 500,000 of us dancing in the streets, throbbing with amplifiers and harmony. We are making love in the parks. We are reading, singing, laughing, printing newspapers, groping and making a mock convention and celebrating the birth of a free America in our own time.
Who wrote that?
Ooh. This is the announcement for the Festival of Life at the Democratic National Convention. It's the Yippie Party, the Youth International Party.
Sounds great.
Sounds like a really great time. Yeah. We should use that this year.
And so this is something else which we spoke about yesterday as well. Rock and roll is proclaimed by adherence as a way to bring about a new world order, the revolution, right? And you have critics of rock music saying this is poisoning our children, it's a communist plot, this is destroying our society, men with long hair and women without bras, and oh, it's a disaster, right? And I've also been looking at a history of rock and roll in the Soviet bloc. And right, Western music was not allowed in the Soviet bloc. Often it was very limited, and there was a great panic about Western music breaking down socialist empire, whatever you want to call it. So I find it very interesting the way that rock music is always attributed as this powerful, powerful thing that can corrupt everybody, or in this case, save everybody. And everybody puts it in these extreme terms without looking at more of the potential across the board. But it's interesting that communist countries are saying Western music's going to undermine socialism, and American critics are saying rock music is communist plot to destroy America.
Some really good lyrics there, I guess. Yeah.
and so, you know, the Kingsman song, Louie Louie, we've all heard it. The FBI spent 2 years investigating the lyrics of that song because they said it was some kind of obscene record. And my favorite part is there's actually a word of profanity in the song because the drummer, like, I don't remember if he hits his hand or drops his drumstick, but it's in the thing in the background. And the FBI didn't find that part. And so there's all this concern about, oh, well, there's satanic messages in the music. And another of my favorite... questions?
I'm still stuck on, like, is music now affecting political change? And I want to come back to that conversation at some point.
What do you think?
I think absolutely yes. And I just think about, like, things that I'm involved with where music has been a huge part and ways it's shaped me and stuff. But it looks really different than what we just watched and what it looked like in the 60s. And part of that, I think, is to do with the digitization of music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's completely changed how people relate to it. And maybe it's not as much of a political force as it is a force in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is it seems now it's more of a social force rather than a political.
I think drawing a line between social and political forces is dangerous because politics only exists because we have a society. You know, like, it, like, social forces push politics even if we don't realize it. It's not, I guess, kind of like Everett was saying, it seems to me like it might not look the same, but it's still affecting it. And just because we can't look back at it yet, we don't see it in the same ways that we can say, these are the songs that were on the bridge. You know, these are the songs that were part of the
movement. Sure.
But, like, even, like, I don't know if everyone here has heard, like, Old Town Road. Like, the most popular song this year became so popular. And, like, it was the first time that a black queer person was on the top of the country charts. And it wasn't, like, a call to action necessarily, but just by existing, it was a political force.
Mm-hmm.
And by getting that kind of popularity. And I think that the movement behind it, empowering people to be in those spaces, was powerful enough to be considered, like, part of a political change, you know?
This session has been successful. And this is exactly the, as I've already said before, I don't have answers. All I have is questions. And these are the kind of questions I want us to think about, is what is the role, what does it mean that a black queer country artist has the number one song in America for 7,000 weeks in a row.
So my question to that is, what political change came from that occurrence? I don't see a political change occurring from that. I see,
a slow change. Like, maybe that change is the empowerment of 10,000 young black queer people who suddenly feel emboldened.
Certainly hope so.
Me too. I would love that.
I hope that happens.
Rise up and vote and change how things are decided.
Because the political...
But I think there's an important question right here.
In this political season,
we can see the value of this in terms of, well, society's changing and there's, you know, music is functioning differently, right? And the question that I think you're asking has to do with, well, what are the political implications of this? Are we going to be in 2020 right where we've been?
Precisely.
Hanging off the side. Mm-hmm. And right, there's a lot about Chicago in 1968 that, like, it did. I mean, were they trying to get Richard Nixon elected? They would say they weren't, but you have to ask the question, and what's the implications of all of this? You're going to go and say, we're going to put LSD in the water. Well, the police are happy to believe that, even if it's a stupid idea. And that's something that, you know, we're certainly not going to decide today or even this year, is What do these things mean? Well, we're not going to understand that fully, maybe ever. But it's interesting that you've both raised, all three of you have raised this point about, well, maybe this is functioning differently and it means things that we don't fully see or they don't fit into the older, the traditional frameworks of thinking about it. And that's good.
Yeah, you know, my 15-year-old son didn't really even thought it was a catchy song, and I mean he's 15, so he didn't really care. And to me, him, it was just a guy making a song. I think that is a sign of he doesn't have to put all these labels on. Look how cool this is that this guy did it. It was like, right. Oh yeah, he made a weird song that like he can't stop humming and singing, and it was in the Super Bowl ad for the Doritos.
There you go.
You know, talk about a broad audience.
But so that also brings us to a very interesting example. The Black Panther Party had a singing group called the Lumpin', which is short for the Lumpin' Proletariat, which you are all familiar with from your reading of Marx. And so part of the framework, it's just an interesting example. Okay, so the Black Panther Party is gathered to distribute their newspaper. And the way they describe it is, well, they were singing a song as they were wrapping the newspaper for distribution, and they were like, hey, that song's really good, you guys should sing for the Black Panther Party. And they said, yeah, okay. And they're all about how they're, you know, members of the party first, and that's more important than being musicians. It's not to say that they don't take their music seriously, because soul music is an extension of the Black identity in this time and place, and so they have to be committed to their soul singing. And so they become, in these words, a living, breathing, you know, arm of the party, the cultural arm of the party, reaching out to communicate the message of the Black Panther Party. And they even have some records. Of course, records are sold and bought, and, you know, is a record successful if nobody buys it? Well, obviously not. The Lumpin' didn't last very long, and the Black Panther Party was targeted hugely by COINTELPRO, and many of the leaders were shot or jailed and et cetera, et cetera, and on and on and on. But it's interesting the extent to which a political party was trying to use music in order to further its cultural and political goals. Mm. And I think part of the question is, who is a musician in this era that's popular that has a consciousness of all of the implications of what's going on? And
seems like it's an untapped resource that, like, I don't see the leaders I would like to be elected tapping into that. Right. So maybe that's a void.
Well, I think we can all agree on that. Yeah. All the people with a microphone are speaking the same language. Yeah. Okay. So we're short on time, and I just want to touch on a couple things quite quickly. We talked about Chicago a little bit. There's a gathering in San Francisco called the Human Being in 1967, and people called it the birth of the counterculture. And it was kind of a spontaneous event with all of the countercultural thinkers and poets, Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg and Jerry Rubin and other people are there, and the Grateful Dead play, and the Human Being. It's just about people being together in the park, and 20,000 people gather in Golden Gate Park kind of spontaneously. And this becomes an example that people try to appeal to, and it's, you know, it's certainly underneath the aspects of Woodstock. Woodstock works because the hog farm, it's a commune in New Mexico, comes out and helps out. They kind of do all this work that security would traditionally do, but because they're friendly hippies who are giving out food, they help hold things together, and everybody has in a good mood at Woodstock, and everybody thinks it's great, and they're going to say the Woodstock Nation, and they have all these meetings to say how do we repeat Woodstock, and this leads 4 months later to Altamont, where there's all this bad LSD, everybody's freaking out, the Hell's Angels are acting in security, somebody gets killed in front of the stage, they continue the concert. And this is just at the end of 1969, in the midst of Charles Manson and police violence and the Black Panthers being murdered and Fred Hampton and all of these things, and, you know, Pearl Harbor Day. And, you know, Richard Nixon's president, the escalation of the Vietnam War. You have Kent State 6 months later. All of these things are happening, you know, People's Park riot, the Chappaquiddick incident, all these things are, I looked at the headlines for 1969, and it's really a lot is happening at once.
Didn't we land on the moon, too?
What's that?
Didn't we land on
the moon? The moon landing happened in June, or July.
Or did it?
I have a list.
The movie of it happened.
That's right.
There was a movie, so it's true.
I understand from my friend that works at NASA that faking the moon landing would have been much harder than actually landing on the moon. So I'll let you take it from there. All of this is to say that rock and roll music, which draws on, of course, the blues and gospel and all of these things, there's a genealogy here. Rock and roll played an important role in the countercultural trend in the 60s. And a lot of it, I mean, that's what classic rock is. It's the same 15 songs that come from that era over and over and over again.
But they're good ones.
They are good ones. And so all of this is to say that, you know, what are the consequences of the 60s? Well, they continued into the 70s. And that's clearly a premise for the 80s. And up until now, as we revisit these questions yet again, and how does the Freedom Songs and the Beatles underlie Old Town Road, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of this is to look at what role does music play in motivating people or giving them impetus to change their attitudes about how they feel or what they're going to do. What role does it play as entertainment? And, oh, it's stuck in my head, but it's not going to make me go and do something. And then you have people saying, oh, well, Tupac's record caused this guy to shoot a Texas state trooper. And they put that forward as a real argument. We should sue Tupac because this guy shot somebody. Or, you know, there's all the Marilyn Manson and backmasking and Paul McCartney is dead. And music is a huge, huge industry, and everybody is upset about it if you don't like their favorite artist, and so on and so forth. And yet, we still have questions around, do you have access to health care, and can you vote, and all of these different questions, right? Can you be fired for being gay, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of this continues to be a question. And I want to certainly have time for questions. We're going to end in a minute, but I am still here until tomorrow. I'm happy to talk about all of this with you more. And I want to have a quote here. Music, okay. African-American poet Gene Toomer said, "Music, however, though able to transport you into a different world, cannot keep you in the other world. Once it is over for the time being, you slide back into this world." But Toomer was right up until that last part. We always slide back into this world, but each time we slide back in, forever changed. And the other quote by Josh Kuhn from yesterday, he said, "Music can't stop bullets, break chains, or tear down walls, but it can help keep you alive." So that's what I got. Feel free to stay or go or ask questions or not.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for sharing. Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
I'm thinking about the climate change and environmental justice movement. And I don't know of any ways in which music has been really influential to that movement, but I was imagining the scenario where, because we've had this age of total digitization of music and went through the whole Napster thing and now we're at Spotify, and it's sort of, I feel like it's kind of like reached an edge of, or end of some cycle there, and like it's kind of stabilized, like our digitization has stabilized into something that like everybody uses and isn't changing as rapidly when you're, maybe that's wrong, but I feel like it's kind of reached some stabilization, and we're also like on the cusp of almost kind of this giant rejection of all our technological advances because of all the harm they've done us, and we're sort of rejecting plastics and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how that will affect how music is consumed, and if that change in how we relate to music will show up in the environmental movement. I'm just thinking about
that. It's a very interesting point. I also note that people are selling, Target is selling records again. Vinyl records.
They Target. Also sell CDs in 2019.
Wow.
Vinyl records for the first time.
And it's like, oh, there's all these records at Target. Like,
yeah.
Which is also terrible for the environment.
I know.
Like, making that much vinyl, like, the production of it is so bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing they used to do in the Soviet bloc was apparently they would cut records onto X-ray backing.
Whoa.
So, like, this was a... It was an underground thing. They would get X-rays and cut records onto them.
Wow.
Is there a reason that they chose X-rays? Was it like
because it was something that cut well?
Okay.
Because I'm using a product, right?
Yeah.
It's taking a waste product.
Right. It's something that's
free.
That's like the. Remember the records we got in National Geographic magazines,
yeah.
Like the Apollo mission, the flimsy,
yeah.
And that's probably the same sort of X-ray material.
And then, right, everything's wrapped in plastic, and then in the box with tape, and then it's got another box, and so it's a
shift here and there
for a flash drive. And then, right, what's the I don't know what the actual like environmental impact of streaming is.
Mm.
Comparatively low, but relative to plastic records.
Okay.
But when you had plastic records, you had album covers that had art on it, and that was your art. When you get a digital album, you just get this digital stuff that you can't hold and necessarily share. Well, you can share it in auction.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not, this isn't the environmental impact, but I mean, streaming is just like ruining artists' lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, they don't get paid.
You get pennies on
the
dollar,
yeah.
For like making a record, you know.
It's also dependent on the internet, and there are some people who are, I've been hearing arguments for like creating internet free spaces. I mean, Holden is kind of one, and like recognizing the value of a space without electromagnetic radio waves. And so if you are creating those spaces, you can't be streaming. So what are you going to do? Are you going to use records? Are you going to make your own music?
Well, I was going to bring my record player, but...
There's only one.
Oh, why didn't you tell me that? You could have brought a whole...
Our albums, our daughter has bought a turntable and all of our old albums that have been stuffed in the back of the closet, she's playing.
I think the streaming of music, one thing that music available on things like Spotify or Pandora or whatever it was, it wasn't necessarily, obviously not good for an artist, but it does give us contact with people we could never get contact with. I found artists that now I follow them all the time and I try to see them. Of course, they don't ever come here. They live all in Texas. But it does get artists to other people that would normally not get them because I don't go to the store. I mean, I guess records when we were growing up were you waited for the next record from this person and then you went to the store and you bought it. And
it's
now
just,
you can get it instantly.
Yeah, it's just a matter of like buying it when you know you discover him and then you realize you like him and then
buy
I'm going to keep listening to this. I better pony up and give him the $12 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't mean to sound like I do that every time. I'm guilty of like being part of that system that Spotify is capitalized on, but you know. it's a great way to share, but it's also like, you know, makes the industry so much
less profitable.
Yeah, well, less profitable for...
Well, people can't make a living doing it, and it used to be you could make a living and...
Yeah, like potentially, like if you could get signed, but like now it's, you know, it's the same thing. Like if I, any music that I put out, like I have music online, but it's not on Spotify. But, you know, there's also like a like the legality of like putting music into Spotify, like they then own part of it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Pretty convoluted, but but now you can, your music can be accessible where you don't need a recording contract. You don't
there definitely are benefits. Yeah.
One thing though is the price of concerts just to go see people entertain has become so prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. I mean,
half the reason I moved to New York was to be around people that so I could like go to see shows, like all right. See all this music. Just, like, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so I might even have a picture with the things off. Columbia Records released an ad. It had all these long hairs fresh from the protest in the jailhouse with their signs on the floor, and they're all in the jail cell. And the ad says, "The man can't bust our music." Underneath it says, "Especially if you're armed with these." The latest release is from Columbia Records.
Wow. Do you know who the artists were? That were incarcerated?
Oh, it's not artists, it's just, you know, protesters.
Oh. Hmm. Okay.
Good. 505, I'm gonna play Solomon Burke, and you can listen or not.
Stiff?
A little stiff.
Yeah, maybe.